You ever leave the house and feel like you're forgetting something? This morning I forgot my PowerPoint. So you get to stare at that. Hopefully you brought your Bibles. So I know you probably have them on your phone. We're in 2 Kings chapter 2. Please forgive me for that. So here we are in 2 Kings chapter 2. And you would expect that we would be studying, well, kings, right? But there will be no mention of kings in this chapter, as we'll see, only prophets. Because kings have taken a back seat for the time being, especially in the northern kingdom of Israel. Widespread idolatry had not escaped God's notice, and the prophets have come in His name to confront evil. One prophet in particular has run his race, and it is now time for him to pass the baton to his teammate. Let's read, starting in verse 1 of 2 Kings chapter 2. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." Now, the exact same thing is going to happen. It's going to repeat itself. Elijah is going to be sent to Jericho now, and he tells Elisha to stay back in Bethel. And it kind of reminds you of the story of Ruth and Naomi. You know, where you go, I'm going to go. There was this loyalty that Elisha had to Elijah. He swears an oath. He's not going to leave him. They go to Jericho, and the company of prophets there in Jericho, same thing. They tell Elisha what he already knows, and he tells them, keep quiet about this. Kind of reminds us of that, you know, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus telling his disciples, you know, tell no one. So there's some secrecy here. And we jump to verse 6. The scene is going to change again, and we're going to see a partial repeat of the first two scenes. It says, "Then Elijah said to him, 'Stay here. The Lord has sent me to the Jordan.' And he replied, 'As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you.' So the two of them walked on. 50 men of the company of prophets went and stood at a distance facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over onto dry ground." This is intentionally reminiscent of Moses, and it's often pointed out that Elisha was to Elijah as Joshua was to Moses. In fact, even their names are practically identical in meaning. Joshua means the Lord saves, and Elisha means God saves. More on that later, but don't forget about that cloak. Verse 9, when they crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" Did you hear about the three guys who were stranded on a desert island? And they'd been there for years, and they were digging in the sand one day, and they came across a lamp. And if you ever find a lamp in the sand, what's the first thing you do? You rub it, right? And then a genie pops out. So this genie popped out, and this is not a true story, kids. The genie popped out, and he said, "Look, there are three of you. I usually grant three wishes, but since there are three, you each get one. I'm sorry, that's the best I can do." And the first guy says, "No problem. All I need is one." He said, "I'm just dying to be with my family. Can't wait to, be, you know, send me home." So poof, genie sends him back home. The second guy says, boy, I'd love to be original here, but I'm just going to, same thing as that guy. I want to go home, want to be with my family. So the genie sends him back home. And the third guy says, well, I don't have a family. I sure do miss my friends. I wish they were back. If you only get one wish, don't screw it up, okay? Elisha gets to make one wish here, I guess you could say. What would you say if you were Elisha in this situation? Would you ask for gold or silver? Maybe you've got a health issue. I want to be free of this health problem that I've been struggling with. Maybe some of us today would actually ask to get stranded on a desert island if we've been watching the news, right? Get me out of here. Surely Elisha isn't going to use his wish on a selfish desire, or is he? He says, let me inherit a double portion of your spirit. Now, here's what that looks like to us. That looks like, Elijah, you were pretty powerful. I want to be twice as powerful. And you were pretty important. I want to be twice as important as you. I want to have twice the ministry that you had. That's what it looks like to Americans. But we need to interpret Elisha's request not through this American lens, but within an ancient Jewish context. And if you go to Deuteronomy 21, you don't have to turn there. I think it's middle of the chapter somewhere. But if you go to Deuteronomy 21, you see that this idea of a double portion related to inheritance rights. And the double portion was something that the oldest son was entitled to. And so Elisha seems to be saying, I want to be as a son to you. I want to carry on your work when you are gone, just as a son would carry on his father's work. And Elijah's response here, verse 10, you have asked a difficult thing. Elijah had offered, what can I do for you? And Elisha hasn't asked him anything that's within his power to grant. This would have to be up to God. And who knows what God would answer. But Elijah gives him kind of a way to know. In fact, for both of them to know. Yet, if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise, not. Now, something really strange is about to happen. Strange, but not altogether unprecedented. In the Old Testament, demonstrations of God's presence and or his power were often accompanied by fire. Can you think of some examples of that? Well, we just looked at one last week, right? Where Elijah is up on this hill and the people come from King Ahaziah and they say, man of God, come down. And he says, if I'm a man of God, then let fire come out and consume you and your men. And that happened twice. And fire, a lot of times, is associated with God's presence and his power. We've got Mount Carmel, that incident that we looked at. We've got when the children of Israel were in the desert, the pillar of fire by night that was leading them. The burning bush. Lots of examples in the Bible. But this one is a little different. The fire takes on a unique form. Verse 11 continues, as they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this. So there's your answer to the request, the double portion request, Elisha. It's a yes. Which explains what he says next. It says he saw this and cried out, my father, my father. The chariots and horsemen of Israel. Chariots and horsemen of, we might think that they would say of God. Or we might think he would say the chariots and the horsemen of heaven. Isn't that interesting? He says, the chariots and the horsemen of Israel. Who are they? And why did he call them that? I'm going to make you wait until chapter 6 before we answer that question. And no cheating, no looking ahead. I'm kidding. You can look ahead. The story continues. And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them apart. Now, according to an early and established tradition, it's believed that Elijah never died. Elijah and Enoch would be the two people that were told never died, according to Jewish tradition. But does the story explicitly say that here? Look at the text. It doesn't. And this theory that Elijah never died is weakened, at least a little bit perhaps, by Elisha's reaction. Because the tearing of one's clothes, that was a customary way to mourn someone's death. And so he does what people do when they lose someone to death. And then if you add to this the talk of receiving a double portion, which was something that happened after death, then it kind of puts it in a little bit of doubt, at least. And so I'm not saying that Elijah didn't die, but there are people who think that on his way up, that his spirit left his body and that he did experience death. I don't think we can know for sure. But I do think it's important that we not just assume that that tradition is correct. One other thing very quickly, and this is real minor, but I bring this up to make a point. I recently said something publicly about Elijah going to heaven in a chariot of fire. And a brother corrected me and he said, no, it was in a whirlwind. Well, lo and behold, the text doesn't say that he rode up to heaven in a chariot of fire. It doesn't say that. Now, I suppose the whole thing could have got, like, he could have hopped in the chariot of fire like an amusement ride or something, and the whole thing goes up to heaven in the whirlwind, I suppose, but I don't know why we would assume that. So where had I come up with this idea that Elijah rode to heaven in a chariot of fire if the text didn't say it? And I got to thinking about that. And I think it was an old Rich Mullins song. Anybody remember Rich Mullins, the music artist? I think I would sing it for you, but my children have asked me not to sing in sermons anymore. So, yeah, I think that's where I got it. I think that's how it got into my head. And I think it's always good to ask the question, where did I get this idea about God? Or where did I get this idea about heaven? Or about Jesus? Or about salvation? Or whatever it is. Is it actually in the text? Or is it something that maybe I just picked up along the way somewhere? Or maybe it's a tradition. I think we have to be careful about that. I don't think that this is a great big deal necessarily. But just in general, you know, sometimes we have Christian movies and Christian books. And they will fill in the blanks a little bit. So they'll give what we know from the Word. And then they'll give a little bit more. And there's a movie about Jesus that I saw one time that had this touching scene where Jesus is kind of, you know, when he was an adult, he was a carpenter. And I can't remember the movie, Phil, you probably know. But he's laughing with his mom. And I think he even, like, you know, sprays her with water or something. And it was kind of touching. It was kind of just showed the humanity of Jesus. And it was a good reminder that he had human experiences like we all have. But then, you know, the danger is you start to kind of mix that in with what we know for sure. And I think that we need to be careful about that. That's all I'm saying. Does that make sense? Verse 13. You've heard that saying, you can't take it with you. Okay, ask Elijah. He barely gets his feet off the ground, and then the earth just sucks that cloak back down like a magnet. And it's all well and good. God had a purpose for it. Verse 13 says, Elisha picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and struck the water with it. Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah? He asked. to see if God was going to be with him just as he was with Elijah, to see if, you know, for sure, is he Elijah's Joshua? He takes that cloak and he does exactly what he saw Elijah do. He strikes the water, and the words that he spoke, or the question that he asked, I think shows us that he didn't see the cloak as some magical thing. The power was in God. It wasn't in the fabric, right? Otherwise, why ask the question? When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. Now, in the book of Joshua, after the death of Moses, we read this. The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." And you may remember how that story goes. God promised that the waters would stop. And that's exactly what happened. The water flowing down the Jordan just met this invisible wall, and it all piled up there. And then Joshua and the people walked across. And that was an unmistakable sign to the people that Joshua had been handpicked by God to succeed Moses. In our text here, will the people, the company of prophets who are there, will they remember that story? Will they understand that same sign? Will they know that Elisha has been handpicked by God to succeed Elijah? Verse 15 says, "The company of the prophets from Jericho who were watching said, 'The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha,' and they went to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. 'Look,' they said, 'we are your servants have 50 men. Let them go and look for your master. Perhaps the spirit of the Lord has picked him up and set him down on some mountain or in some valley.'" So these guys who had earlier demonstrated some spiritual discernment into mysteries, now they're kind of just showing that they're a lot like us, right? They have some limitations, and they didn't really know what was going on. Maybe that's understandable because Elijah had this reputation, right? Even Ahab knew this, or Obadiah, that is. Elijah would sometimes just disappear. Nobody would know where he went. So they're saying, "Let's go look for him. Let's see if he's on the mountains." "No," Elisha replied, "do not send them." But they persisted until he was too ashamed to refuse. So he said, "Send them." And this has always baffled me a little bit. I always wondered, why would he be ashamed to refuse them that request? What would be embarrassing about that? And I was pondering that this week, and I think I might have a theory. I wonder if after they kept asking him, Elisha maybe thought, boy, pretty soon they're going to start to wonder about my motives. Like, what's he hiding? And maybe he's liking the spotlight and he doesn't want us to go find Elijah. And maybe that was the thing that made Elisha say, "Okay, go ahead and search." I'm not sure. In any case, they sent 50 men who searched for 3 days but did not find him. Verse 18, when they returned to Elisha, who was staying in Jericho, he said to them, "Didn't I tell you not to go?" So basically, "I told you so." Apparently, it's not polite to say that, but sometimes you have to, right? So it's settled. Elisha is the man, and not just the man. He is God's man. It is through Elisha that God is now going to reveal himself to Israel. And what follows now are 2 short accounts that provide a balanced picture of Israel's God. And when I read these stories together, there's a New Testament verse that just comes into my mind from Romans 11. "Consider therefore the kindness and sternness of God." The kindness and sternness, or the KJV says the kindness and the severity of God. I have a friend that used to believe the Bible. But about 12 months ago, he embarked on a journey of pretty much getting rid of everything he ever believed. I've mentioned him before. You don't know him. But I'm almost sure that at this point he could be described as a universalist. And kids, a universalist is, you just think of the universe. The whole universe is going to heaven. Everybody's going to heaven regardless of their relationship to Jesus Christ or lack thereof. Okay? So my friend has kind of just put away the Bible. And last week, Pastor Phil in chapter 1 drew some similarities between Christopher Hitchens and King Ahaziah, right? Remember that? And King Ahaziah, to the end of his life, was just stubborn and against God to the very end. And that's how Christopher Hitchens was. Remember that? If on my deathbed, if you hear that I had, you know, made a confession of faith, don't believe it, I'm just going to be, you know, in God's face until the very end. And my friend, in the midst of this transformation away from the Bible, my friend told me several months ago, he said, you know, I really believe we're going to see Christopher Hitchens in heaven someday. I really believe that. In his mind, he has stripped God of his holiness. And yet, the book of Hebrews says it's a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And my friend says, oh, I can explain that. That's simply a representation of what the people in that day believed about God. But we're more enlightened now. Okay, so there's that view. That there's no judgment, there's no wrath, there's no holiness. Okay, there's that view. And on the other end of the spectrum are those who think that God is like Zeus. He's just like shooting lightning bolts down to earth. You know, all wrath, no love, all judgment, no grace, no compassion, no kindness, no goodness toward humanity. And both of those views are wrong, as Elisha will soon show us. He is representing the true and living God to Israel. And let's look at these two miracles and gain a balanced perspective of God. Verse 19, the men of the city said to Elisha, look, our Lord, this town is well situated, as you can see, but the water is bad and the land is unproductive. In those days, one of the most important things, one of the most important criteria, if you're going to set up a town or a city or a village, you got to have water. And it's actually that way today. And certainly when Jericho was first founded, the water was good, but it had gone bad. And some people think, well, that was part of the covenant curse that we read about in Deuteronomy. If you ever break the covenant, then I'm going to send drought and I'm going to send enemies and your crops are going to go bad and all of this. You're not going to get rain. And that's probably very likely. It says here that the water was bad, the land was unproductive. And what is God's representative going to do? You know, you think about the perfect representative of God, Jesus Christ, who is the image of the invisible God. He came and he said, I have come that they may have life and life to the full. And certainly we all know how vital water is to physical life, right? Why would it surprise us if God wanted to heal their water? Let's see what he does. Verse 20, bring me a new bowl, Elisha said, and put salt in it. So they brought it to him. Then he went out to the spring and threw the salt into it, saying, this is what the Lord says, I have healed this water. Never again will it cause death or make the land unproductive. And the water has remained wholesome to this day, according to the word Elisha had spoken. Now, question for you. Kids, I want you to think about this. Do you think that it was the salt that healed the water? I'm seeing some head shake. Is that what fixed the water? You know, if only the people had known all along that what that spring needed was just a little salt. Is that it? Try this sometime, kids, okay? This was a warm spring in Jericho, okay? So get yourself a glass of warm water sometime and take a teaspoon of salt and stir that in there and drink it and then tell me how you like it. Anybody ever do that? Yeah, my wife makes me gargle with salt water when I get a sore throat. It's terrible, okay? So she's like, I don't make you. No, she doesn't make me. She just strongly suggests. I think it's actually good for you. But it's not good to drink, okay? Adding salt to water is a way to ruin it, okay? So if anything, throwing that salt in the spring made it worse. And what I think this is about, if we go back to Mount Carmel, right, dousing this altar and drenching it so that when the fire came down from heaven, we know it's not a trick. We know it's from God. And I think that the salt represents, I'm not doing anything to fix this. Okay? This is the word of the Lord. It says, and to this day it remains wholesome. And to this day it remains wholesome. Pretty sure we know where that spring is. That's, you know, right there in Jericho. And I had a picture for you. It's pretty cool. Just imagine it. Isn't that beautiful? See the palm trees? To this day, maybe Greg and Lynn, did you guys go to Jericho? No, you didn't go there. Okay. They let us down. But this miracle links Elisha to his predecessor, Elijah. Remember, Elijah prayed and the land, you know, the rain came. And so it links him to his predecessor, but it also reveals something about God. God is merciful. God wants to bless. It's who God is by his nature. Now think about this. If Jericho was under a curse for apostasy, turning away from their God, how amazing is it that this doesn't record anything about them repenting? What did we see from them? All we saw was this, a little bit of humility to recognize their need for God's intervention. A little bit of humility to ask. That's what God is like. He's merciful. Moving on to verse 23. Okay, consider the kindness and the sternness of God, says the Apostle Paul, Romans 11. Verse 23, from there Elisha went up to Bethel. As he was walking along the road, some youths came out of the town and jeered at him. Go on up, you bald head, they said. Go on up, you bald head. And he turned around, looked at them, and called down a curse on them in the name of the Lord. Then two bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. And he went on to Mount Carmel and from there returned to Samaria. I was talking to Pastor Mike about this story just today, and he said that's one of his Old Testament favorites. And I think, how sick do you have to be to be? When our kids were little, we lived near a town called Albion, Indiana, and they had a little pizza place there called Snappy Tomato. It was actually really good. And we would go to the buffet, and I know what you're thinking. Some of you are saying you have terrible taste in pizza. You like Little Caesars. I'm not believing that this is good. It was good. Anyway, so we were there. They were having their buffet, and a larger guy walked by our table. And Ethan, who was at the time about this big, as the guy passed by, Ethan said, he's fat. And so if you have kids, you know how it is. And so we, you know, as he walked on, we had a talk. And I said, Ethan, you don't say that. You don't, you know. And he was, you know, kids, they just call it as they see it. You know, it's like, and I said, you don't say that, buddy. You could hurt his feelings. And, you know, and I'm trying to help him understand that. And okay. And Ethan felt bad, you know. And so he's not going to do that again. So the guy came back and he sat in the booth right next to him. I could have touched the guy. And Ethan looked at him again and said, he's bald. So thankfully, there were no bears where we lived. at that time. But this story of the bears and Elisha, that's a favorite one of atheists. That's one they like to bring up. God kills little children for teasing someone about being bald. We've all teased people, especially kids. What kind of God is this, you Christians? Always sitting in judgment of God, these atheists. Always talking, never understanding, never bothering to discern what is really going on. You see, Bethel represented rebellion. Represented opposition to God. It was there in Bethel, along with Dan in the north, if you remember, that Jeroboam set up his golden calves, one in Dan, one in Bethel. And Bethel became, it was just this place of idol worship. There was a shrine there, and there were these high places to Baal. Everything about Bethel was rebellious. Everything about Bethel was a fist shaking in God's face, including their children. These youngsters weren't merely teasing Elisha for being bald. They were challenging him. And more importantly, they were challenging his God, Yahweh. In Jewish culture, you may know this, just as a full head of hair represented vitality and strength, you think of Absalom, baldness was associated with weakness. By calling Elisha baldhead, they were mocking him, they were daring him, they were challenging him, and by extension, they were mocking and daring God. Because to insult or to mock or to challenge God's prophet is to do the same with God. And we remember last week, these prophets came up against Elisha, and they were ordering him around. And God demonstrated his power. A better example is to go back to that exact same place in Bethel. Remember when Jeroboam was there and this anonymous prophet of God came and he prophesied against the altar? And what did Jeroboam do? He said, "Seize him." And what happened? His hand shriveled up. Remember that? To challenge God's true prophet was to challenge God, to mock God. "Go on up, you bald head." What that means is we're not afraid of you, and we're not afraid of your God, your weak God. They had learned their parents' rebellion well. Consider the kindness and sternness of God. Are there still mockers today? Are there still those who shake their fists at heaven, challenging the living God? You better believe it. Have you been paying attention? Blaspheming is quickly becoming a national pastime. Because of God's great mercy, Jesus came to earth humbly to be mocked the first time. Upon his return, he will not be mocked. We sang this morning, "Every knee will bow." "Penalties are prepared for mockers," Proverbs 19 says, "and beatings for the backs of fools." Don't get caught up in a crowd of mockers. Don't hang with that group. The bears will come out of the woods. I don't know when. Fear God. Honor his word. What God delights in, what God really wants to do, is to heal, to show mercy, to bring grace and compassion. And so be humble before him. Consider the kindness and sternness of God.